I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. I've just started an engrossing, accessible, highly readable book, Memoirs of an Addicted Brain. A neuroscientist examines his former life on drugs. Its author, Mark Lewis, joins me now. Dr. Lewis is a distinguished neuroscientist who for many years was a drug addict himself. He describes in this book how his addictions manifested itself, what happened, and how he eventually overcame all that which affected his early life. Clean for some 30 years now, he's currently a professor of human developmental psychology at Radboud University in...
Radboud, yes.
My vowels are loose. University in the Netherlands. He was at the University of Toronto for over 20 years. This is a fascinating book in that we get Dr. Lewis's own story, as well as all the science behind what's really happening in our brains. In that, it's incredibly accessible. We also attempt to understand addiction more, not just from an academic and scientist like Dr. Lewis, but from someone who's literally been there and done that. And it's not just drugs in this book. We read about our addictions to stuff like love, soap operas, wealth. We'll get Dr. Lewis to explain more. The website for more is at memoirsofanaddictedbrain.com. The book is published by Doubleday. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Mark Lewis. Good morning, Dr. Lewis.
Hi there. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us.
Welcome.
So the idea of telling your own story making it informative and interesting, was that necessary for your own self in being an addict? Did you need to tell us?
No, I actually quit 30 years ago. The idea of this book came up about 4 or 5 years ago. I wanted to bring moment-to-moment life experience, how we, our thoughts, our feelings, our day-to-day events, together with processes going on in the brain. They happen at the same time, and I thought there might be a way to weave them together in a narrative that's exciting and compelling. And the story of my years of addiction was the vehicle for that. And then as I was writing, it kind of got more and more personal and more detailed, and I basically told the long winding road that led from one thing to another, and it eventually led to a very difficult place that I finally was able to get out of.
So are all brains created equal? Like, do we all have the ability? I mean, are we all addicts or addicted is essentially the question.
Well, no, I don't think we are. And brains grow. They're not finished products at birth. They're just gigantic open systems that are ready to be fired up by experience. So different kinds of life experiences, different kinds of childhood events and traumas and difficulties in the ways that we have available for dealing with them will grow different kinds of circuits, different kinds of networks of patterns in the brain. And so we become radically different human beings, and that includes addicts, and that includes other people with mental health problems.
So we've heard over the years that it's a disease, that addicts are born a certain way. In your research and in your career, is that the case?
No, I think that's nonsense. There's a certain amount, and people keep looking for addictive genes, and there are some correlations with alcoholism that seem to have to do with genetic predispositions, but there's no gene, and there's no particular set of genes that can be singled out. So, no, I don't think addicts are born. I think addicts are raised.
So it's a decision, is it, or?
No, it's not a decision. I mean...
Because that's the other argument.
You're right.
Yeah.
You're right. That's how it goes. There's this ongoing debate between the disease model, which is sort of a version of a genetics model, versus the choice model, or the, you know, yeah, they're free to do it or not. And neither of them is very accurate, in my view, because if you think about choice, how often are our choices free choices? They're based on a level playing field. People make choices according to who they are, what their options are, what kind of a life they have, and what kinds of difficulties they are facing. And those choices are going on in the brain, and that's the brain that, you know, that's been developing since you were born, and therefore it's going to have a lot to do with the resources that are there inside your body and outside your body in your social environment.
So how do we know if we're addicted?
There's so many definitions of addiction. How do we know? I think the definition that I prefer is when people are compelled to repeat something over and over again, even though in large part it's awful, it's horrible, they don't like it. Actually makes them feel worse rather than better, but they can't stop wanting it, and they can't stop pursuing those desires and doing it. That's definitely addiction. So there's other definitions as well, but that one works for me.
Yeah, and then so how does the brain work in terms of dealing with that? It tells us that you know, that's probably not good to do this thing or that thing, but we still do it.
Yeah, for sure. So, obviously, you have a kind of an objective perspective on this, and you know that this is not good. You've lost your wife, your girlfriend, your boyfriend, your kids, whatever it is, your money. You know that it's hurting you. It's maybe killing you, and yet the circuits that take over when people pursue drugs or alcohol or other things or gambling, things they're addicted to, are in a very particular part of the prefrontal cortex. Close to a part of the brain called the amygdala, which has been in the press a lot. It seems to be a very important component of the neural basis of emotion. And these are highly emotional moments when the brain becomes riveted to a particular goal, to one goal. And then you get chemical changes. There's a great increase in dopamine metabolism, and dopamine is a neurochemical that connects you to the goal, so that's the only thing on the radar, that's the thing on the screen, and you go after that goal, whether it's a piece of cheesecake, or whether it's a lover, or whether it's heroin. So the part of the brain that's involved in addiction and craving and making those decisions is very different from the part of the brain that can reflect and say, yeah, that's, I wish I wasn't doing that, really should stop.
And so, how does the addict then, I guess, change its mind, if you will? How do you get away from that particular area where addiction, I guess, manifests itself? How does one change it? Is it done chemically?
Well, yeah, that's a big question, right? How do you stop?
Yeah.
And of course, that's.
I mean, are there things that one can do to one's brain that could stop it? I mean, we hear, like, you know, the sort of things like patches if you want to quit smoking, or other pills and the sort. I mean, our government here in British Columbia is going to be funding a certain drug, a smoking cessation drug.
Right, I've heard about that.
Yeah, right. does that affect the brain if one takes something like that?
Sure, that's exactly what it does.
Yeah.
So there's different kinds of pharmacological interventions. Some chemicals, some drugs will fill the receptor sites that the drugs would otherwise fill, so that when you take the drugs, it doesn't do anything. There are drugs that will reduce dopamine metabolism so that the sense of desire and craving is not as strong. And there's other neurally based approaches that are being attempted and that may very well work. But, you know, it's obviously it's not an easy thing, because people build their lives around their addictions. So it isn't just the moment of craving, and it isn't just dealing with that moment and how to get past it. It's also the whole structure that you build, the sense of yourself, the community that you live in, the friends that you hang out with, and all that stuff. Drugs, booze, you know, hanging out with the guys at the bar, gambling, it becomes your home. It becomes the way you live, and that's not so easy to change.
What about people that quit smoking cold turkey? What happens in their brain?
Well, I mean, we know that nicotine has a physiological dependency. I think the withdrawal symptoms probably last, I don't know, a week or two, mm-hmm. Maybe a little longer for some. The problem is not so much the physical withdrawal, it's the psychological addiction that keeps coming back. Because cigarettes are such, they're so much a part of our environment, it's easy to come in contact with cigarette cues. And the problem with addiction in many cases is that when the cues, when you see or think about or hear about the thing that you have been addicted to, it immediately increases the levels of dopamine in areas of the prefrontal cortex, the ventral striatum, and a few areas that I talk about in the book, and hopefully in pretty accessible ways, and says, I want it. I want it now. Yes, that's what I want. And those processes are automatic. You can't control that wanting. What you control is the way, what you do about it, but you can't control the wanting.
Has the brain changed over the years? I mean, I know that we develop, but I mean in terms of how it actually acts and the sort, has that changed at all in the last 100 years, if you will?
Oh, I see. Well, I don't think so.
No.
Biological evolution, you know, takes time.
Have technological, like, I mean, we hear about cell phones and the sort. I mean, does that affect the way that the brain is shaped?
Well, every experience that's important and that you take in, that every act of learning changes the brain.
Yeah.
Whether you're learning to play the piano or learning to, you know, ride a bicycle or whatever it is, or learning to become attached to a drug, that becomes affects wiring. It affects, it builds circuits and it grows circuits and then it reinforces circuits. So technological implements, parts of our lives that have to do with technology, video games, cell phones, etc., yeah, they have big impacts on how we understand ourselves and our world, and yes, those are recorded in the brain. But, you know, the brain's been evolving for a really long time, roughly 500 billion years,
yeah.
And it doesn't change quickly. The fundamental circuits and the fundamental mechanisms are pretty much what we're stuck with as human beings.
To your life, growing up, what did you want to be when you were a kid?
What I want to be?
Yeah. Did you want to be a doctor?
No, I'm not a doctor. I'm a psychologist.
A scientist. Yeah. Did you want to do that?
No, I didn't want to do that till I turned 25. That's when I really started to want to pursue psychology, and my addictions got in the way. The book is, I mean, a large part of the book is about very personal struggles, and there's a lot of detail about some pretty dark things that I did and things that I got involved in, some of which were very attractive and exciting, and others of which were horrendous and frightening. And there's a lot of that in the book. But so I was pursuing psychology for a while. I wanted to be a psychologist. Then I got busted for stealing drugs. I got kicked out of school. I had to go back to becoming, you know, to doing things like window washing and painting houses for a living, and took a while to get back on track and pursue those goals again, and finally become successful in academia. As a kid, I don't know, probably wanted to be a fireman like everybody else.
Yeah. So you were going to school, and you talked to, you just mentioned it, you got busted stealing drugs out of the, the lab, I guess, right?
Well, no, I was busted for stealing drugs from medical centers.
Okay. Yeah.
That came after stealing drugs from the labs. I got more bold this time.
So what happened? I mean, the sort of change into focusing on books and school. How does that happen? I mean, do you have an explanation of what happened in your head?
When what exactly? Sorry?
When you decided to get away from drugs and then really focus on school and becoming a scientist.
Yeah, well, there was kind of a cascade of events. Like many addicts, I had tried to stop many times, and sometimes that would last for a week or a month or 2 months, and then I'd go back to it. And, of course, that's really one of the most awful things about addiction is the failures to stop. And then finally, I guess things got bad enough. I was really miserable. My girlfriend ditched me for good reasons. My friends found me in a comatose state and brought me home. It was extremely shameful. I was taking really serious chances, mixing really bad drugs. And it got so aversive, so disgusting, that I guess there was a tipping point. And I was able to say, a part of me was able to say, I really, really, really don't want to do this anymore at all. And I was able to kind of put that in the front of my mind and go back to it many times a day. And stay there, and then things got easier for a few weeks, and then even more easy.
The feelings of inadequacy.
I won the book.
Yeah, the feelings of inadequacy and shame. Those are, I guess, the biggest impediments, aren't they?
Yeah, they're pretty big. Yeah.
Yeah. How did you deal with those?
Well, shame is a huge part of addiction.
Yeah.
Nobody likes an addict, including addicts, right? I mean, you know, the things that you're doing are awful, and yet you feel you can't stop, and self-control is something that we humans value above almost everything else. So when you start to lose self-control, there's not too much to be proud of. How did I deal with it? I tried, I guess, I mean, you go from day to day. So during those years, I was kind of a Jekyll and Hyde. I was a successful student for a while. I was, you know, doing fairly well. I got into graduate school in psychology, and I was able to focus on some of those achievements. But then I'd go off at night and do terrible things, steal drugs and take terrible chances. And you know, so I guess I just kind of kept going until finally there seemed a way to resolve it.
I read a piece that you wrote in Toronto Life about, I guess you'd hurt your back, sciatica, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and so the doctor, you had to have an operation. The doctor prescribes oxycodone.
Mm-hmm. Oxycodone, yeah.
Oxycodone. And so it's a highly addictive drug, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So how did you deal with getting on that, getting off that?
It gave me a scare. I mean, there's, as I read about in the book, and as I think people understand, once an addict, always an addict, those the circuits of meaning and value, they don't disappear. You can build pathways around them and detours around them, but they don't disappear. And so when I was in a lot of pain. My family and I had just moved to the Netherlands, and the bottom of my spine was putting a lot of pressure. The bones were intruding on the spinal cord, and it was really painful, so I didn't have much choice. So I was on those drugs again, and besides the pain relief, there was a feeling of attraction. There was that feeling of well-being that I remembered so well from all those years ago. It was a reminder that you have to be careful. You have to be careful your whole life. You have to be careful not to go there again. So when it was time, after the surgery, the pain was much reduced, and after a while I found I could do enough yoga and physiotherapy to control the pain, and I had, you know, one day I said to the doctor, okay, that's it, I got to stop, and it was over. It was like an echo of the old days, but of course nowhere near to how bad it had been many years ago.
What's it like living in the Netherlands?
I like it a lot. Yeah. We're living in a town of about 150,000, and people are friendly and nice and open and straightforward. There are fields and forests around us, and Europe is great. Our kids, we've got 5-year-old twins, and they're happy, and my wife and I have jobs at the university, and so it's a good life.
Yeah, what's the weather like there?
Well, the weather's not necessarily the best point.
Yeah.
It's a bit like Vancouver weather, I think.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Yeah.
but it's exciting because it can be sunny one moment, and then a half an hour later it's pouring, so you never know what's happening. There's a certain amount of drama in the weather.
Just like today.
Yeah.
What do you want people to learn from this book?
I think people have told me that the book is a coming-out story. It's a compelling read. There's a lot of details about what it's like to be an addict and what it's like to have to deal with those impulses, and a lot of different drug experiences in the U.S. and in Canada and in Asia and in the opium dens of Calcutta. So I think it's a good read, but also it goes back and forth between real life and neuroscience in a way that should be accessible to regular people. And I think you can start to understand addiction based on that combination between real life and brain processes. You can actually get a kind of perspective on it that should be richer and deeper than we often have access to.
Dr. Lewis, I'm very much looking forward to finishing this book. Continued good luck with it.
Well, thank you very much.
You're very welcome. The website for more, memoirsofanaddictedbrain.com. The book is called Memoirs of an Addicted Brain, A Neuroscientist Examines His Former Life on Drugs. It's published by Doubleday. Its author, Mark Lewis, on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.